The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's a challenge that all parents face, how to explain to little ones, sometimes not so little ones, how they came into the world. It's a kind of template most parents follow. It may start with the metaphor of seeds or soil, or the more direct version that men have penises and women have vaginas. But at a time when our collective understanding of gender is becoming more flexible, and even conception is a very different story, is there a more creative way to explain where babies come from? One new book has a different approach, answering the question, what makes a baby, without using any gender terms at all. Corey Silverberg is a sexuality educator and founding member of the Come As You Are Cooperative and author of What Makes a Baby. That's the first book in a series that teaches readers about gender, sexuality, and sexual health. And Corey, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So where'd you get the idea to write a book like this?
Well, when I grew up, actually, my mom was a children's librarian, and my dad was a sex therapist, and I grew up in Canada. And so I had all these, you know, I had all the books that were available about where babies come from and about sexuality, but none of them really fit for me. I was what now we would call a gender nonconforming kid. So anyway, so I grew up, and I kind of always knew that the books that were out there weren't enough. They weren't for everyone. And then all of my friends started having kids, and a lot of my friends are transgender. And there's a specific family that I really wrote the book. The first version of this book was written for a specific family that was a trans family. The dad was trans. The mom wasn't. They had a four-year-old, and they were having another baby. And I was very close with the four-year-old, and he started asking questions. And as you already said, all of the books that are out there, they, you know, pretty much they say, well, you get a sperm from your dad, an egg from your mom, and they're the two people who raise you. And they describe a family that more and more is not, I mean, you know, it's a smaller and smaller part of the world of families that we have. Mm. So Beto's dad asked if I would, you know, he knew I was always talking about, oh, one day I'll write this book. And he said, you know, could you just get on it and just do it? And so I did it. I wrote a story that worked for them. And of course, what happened over a two-year process of writing and rewriting is we discovered that it kind of works for everyone.
Well, let me ask you how it works, because I'm thinking that, mm-hmm. you know, whether you're adopted, whether your parents right. got you through some sort of surrogacy or technology,
right.
I mean, those kids
exactly.
can feel kind of left out of the equation that if there's a mommy in it, when a daddy really loves a mommy.
Right, exactly, right. And even, like in this case, my friend's children, they have a mom and a dad, but the sperm didn't come from the dad. Which can be true for trans families, but as you said, I mean, it can be true for a lot of straight families, too, and a lot of, like, you know, cisgender families, I guess, non-trans families. So the way that we do it, the big difference is, number one, as you said, you know, we don't talk about moms and dads. My approach as a sex educator is to try to figure out what we can say that's true for everyone. And in 2015, what we can say is, you need an egg, you need a sperm, and you need a uterus. And we can't say much more about where those parts are, where they come from. So the way our book works is that we talk about what you need to make a baby. There's a lot of like beautiful illustrations of families and love. But what we do is we actually leave it to the parents to actually tell the story of how the sperm and the egg came together, and if they want to share whose sperm and egg that was, right? So it might be this, you know, a very simple story of like, well, it was your mom and your dad. Or it might be that Uncle Jack helped us. Or it might be that we tell a story about a doctor that helped. What I discovered was a lot of families that are using reproductive technologies, you know, that aren't necessarily using surrogates per se, that might be even using their own sperm and egg, but that they are actually interested in telling their kids the fact that it wasn't easy, right? One of the problems with a lot of these books is it makes it seem like it's the easiest thing in the world to have a baby. And the truth is it's actually, as a lot of us know, it's not the easiest thing in the world.
Well, you did work with this illustrator, Fiona Smith, and the art is just delightful. The sperm and the egg each come with their own stories, and there's kind of all of these illustrated stories inside
which is
of
DNA.
Them.
It's our idea of DNA.
Right. But there's also, the beings, like, they're absolutely gender neutral. It's like some people have uteruses, some people don't.
Yeah. We even kept it, I mean, the language that we use is sort of some bodies have and some
bodies
don't.
That's it.
Because, and I should say that at the end of the book, we see people who are very clearly gendered. So it isn't about, like, taking gender out of life. But the truth is that sperm and egg, even though, of course, we think of sperm as male, and often you know, in other books we see them, the sperm wears a bow tie and the egg is wearing a tutu. But the truth is that sperm and egg are not gendered, right? They're cells. They're cellular. Gender is something that people have. Gender isn't something that our cells have. So, you know, this has been my approach for the past 20 years as a sex educator, is I just try to take gender out of where it doesn't need to be. And the other thing I'll say is that little kids don't have a problem with this. Like, there are some adults that maybe have a little, they're not really sure about the approach. In our experience, like, this makes perfect sense to little kids.
Well, I wonder, okay, so you talked about the essential role of parents or whoever is reading this book to children having to take a role in the explanation, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes.
But kids are used to looking at all of those books where the feminine is wearing a tutu or, you know, the man is wearing a bow tie. So is it confusing to them to see bodies without, you know, I don't know, they make the women's lips bigger or breasts or
hair
or whatever?
You know what? So in our experience, now this book is written for 4 to 6-year-olds. And so the younger the kids are, the less confusing it is. Because, you know, we aren't born with some hardwired understanding of sex or gender. We may be born with some aspects of it for ourselves, but we don't have a, you know, social understanding of what gender is. It's something we learn. So the older the kid, the weirder this stuff looks, because they are expecting, as you said, they're expecting certain, you know, hip-to-waist ratio. They wouldn't know it, but they're expecting it. But with really young kids, we found that with these illustrations, they just kind of fall into it, partly because it's also a little bit magical. Like, Fiona's not older, she's near my age, but
that's the illustrator, Fiona Smith.
Yeah. And the style is a little psychedelic, but I think that's fine. I think that, you know, as an educator, again, when it comes to sex, we often think we have to be totally scientific because we're kind of nervous about the subject. But of course, making babies is actually magic, right? I don't know if you have any babies in your life, but like I do. And the fact that we humans can make a baby, it is a total miracle, and it's totally magical. And the idea that we have to explain it in a way that is dry and only scientific didn't appeal to Fiona and I. And in fact, we found that the kids love it. So young kids have no problem with these kind of like bodies that almost look like trees. But certainly adults do sometimes, and you know, that's fine. It's
well, I wonder about the adults, because here, I know you're in Canada, but this book is selling briskly in the United States, and
here in the U.S.,
there are a lot of cultural debates over what is gender, binary, conforming, heterosexual. Have you had outright resistance to this book?
Yeah, absolutely. There are people, so the one thing with this book, as I think you said this in the opening, we don't ever reference moms and dads.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do that not because we have a problem with moms and dads. I have many moms in my life and I love them. But because not everyone has both. And certainly not everyone uses those names for them, right? And some people don't have either. And we want, you know, I'm a sex educator. I think that the kid in foster care who's actually having a pretty tough time in the world deserves exactly the same kind of sex education as the kid with the normative family that has all the resources and has a mom and a dad. And, you know, So the fact that we took the words mom and dad out in order to be more inclusive was something that that some people really don't like. And also some people don't like the fact that we say that some bodies have eggs and some bodies have sperm. We don't say women have eggs and men have sperm, because the truth is not all women have eggs. And that's not just an issue of trans, you know, trans bodies. I'll point that out. There are also some women who are born women who everyone would, you know, doctors would refer to as women, who actually have no viable egg.
Right.
And the way that traditional sex education is done shames those women and tells them that they're not real women. And that's part of, even though my focus is on trans inclusion, you know, the way that we talk about sex and gender actually leaves out a lot of people. So That's my little argument. But to answer your question, some people are not comfortable with it. Some people are not comfortable. They don't want to kind of, I guess they don't want to accept the reality, which is that there's way more than two genders and more than two sexes. And that's fine. I mean, I am Canadian, as you said, and I have no interest. I'm not really pushing an agenda. So I think the book works for everyone, but it won't be for everyone.
Well, Corey, thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Corey Silverberg is a sexuality educator and member of the Come As You Are Cooperative and author of What Makes a Baby. That's the first book in a series that teaches readers about gender, sexuality, and sexual health. The more recent addition to the series, Sex is a Funny Word. You can find more about both books at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When the Barbie doll debuted in 1959, she came with a name, Barbara Millicent Roberts, and a profession, teenage fashion model. Since then, Barbie's been busy. She's added 170 careers to her resume, taken on 40 nationalities, and worked with more than 75 fashion designers. Now at 56, she's getting another reboot, this time becoming an artificially intelligent doll. Hello Barbie can talk to children, play games, ask questions, and provide answers, which for kids could create the illusion of being a real friend. Enticing or creepy? Well, James Vlahos wrote about Hello Barbie for the New York Times Magazine. James, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So there have been talking Barbies in the past. What's the difference with this one? What can it do?
Yeah, the big difference is there have been talking Barbies. There have been dozens, if not hundreds, of talking toys. But that's all they could do. They could talk and they couldn't listen. So the big difference here is a girl sits down with Barbie. She says something to Barbie. Barbie is listening using her little computer brain, processing the speech of the child, sending it off to a server in San Francisco, generating a response and sending it back. So you can actually have a conversation with Barbie, which is obviously hugely different than anything that's been done before.
I'm imagining a kind of blonde version of Siri with a very skinny waist. Does the new Barbie look any different?
She looks like a Barbie from the outside. The blonde tresses and the famous or infamously skinny figure. But she is a little bit different. Her chest cavity is slightly larger to fit in the Wi-Fi transmitter and microphone. Her thighs are a little bit thicker, interestingly, to fit batteries that are required to make her work. And then as part of sort of a more general reboot of Barbie that Mattel is trying to do, she has flat feet and she has less makeup than dolls in the past because the toy company says they want to adapt to contemporary tastes of what kids and more importantly the parents think a doll should look like.
Wow. Okay, so how deep do these questions go? How great is her capacity to listen?
You know, it's pretty amazing. She can talk about a lot of the stuff that you would sort of expect a doll that's talking to a kid would talk about. So, you know, what's your favorite color and what's your favorite pet and what do you like to do at school? Sort of all these basic things. But she can also have conversations about feelings, about jealousy, about competitiveness. So she can get into emotional terrain as well. And she is a lot like the technology behind her, which has been created by a company called ToyTalk, which is an artificial intelligence company in San Francisco. It's technology that's similar in some ways to what something like Siri does on your phone, but in some ways it goes even deeper. You can have conversations that are not just sort of a simple exchange back and forth. You know, you might tell Siri, hey, put this on my calendar or send this text message. With Hello Barbie, you can have these conversations that go 10, 20, 30 exchanges deep.
So who came up with this dialogue?
For the most part, it was ToyTalk, the company in San Francisco. It's very interesting. It's an artificial intelligence company, so they have coders and programmers and technologists and all the sorts of people you would expect to see at a Silicon Valley-style startup. But they also they have writers. They have a couple of actors, a woman who's done voiceover work, and they get together in a writer's room. It's picture like what you would see behind the scenes at Saturday Night Live, just young, creative, funny people sitting together and bouncing around ideas for dialogue. And they write all this stuff for Barbie to say. and Mattel reviews it, and if it passes muster, it gets put into Barbie's brain.
This isn't a perfect world, right? I mean, I've had experiences with Siri, and I think everybody has, where you just get so frustrated trying to make her understand something that you just absolutely give up. Is it any different than that experience?
No, they haven't magically solved the problems and challenges with voice recognition technology, but they do a pretty good job of making her listen and understand what's being said. And they have a good strategy for when it fails. And what that comes down to is, you know, kid says something, Barbie tries to decipher what has been said, and if she succeeds, she generates an appropriate response. If she doesn't, she just says something that's sort of bland and affirming that keeps the conversation going. So if she doesn't understand, she just might say, "Oh, how interesting. Tell me more."
I think about watching kids play with dolls, and, you know, when you play along with them, you hold up the stuffed animal or the doll and you make them talk to each other. And kids do the same when they're playing by themselves. And this, having a listening and talking Barbie, overrides that need and that imagination. Any thoughts or research on how this kind of toy will affect kids?
Yeah, this is something, for the New York Times article, I talked to a number of child psychologists and ones who have specifically studied kids and imaginative play. And indeed, they point out that for pretty much as long as there have been toys, kids have talked to those toys, and they've created with their imaginations things for the toys to say back. So there's a lot of concern from those academic researchers, like what happens when the toy's got a brain and it talks all by itself. Is that sort of encroaching on imagination, essentially? So I think that's a legitimate concern. And the thing that, if you bring that up with the people at Toy Talk or at Mattel, what they'll say back is, don't think of it as competing with a typical toy. Think of it as an alternative to television or a tablet or any kind of entertainment where the kids use now, where they sit completely passively and just have, you know, entertainment funneled to them. At least with something like Hello Barbie, it's an interactive process, and there's back and forth, and the kids talking and the dolls talking and so on.
Well, despite her reputation as a starry-eyed, fashion-obsessed doll, there's a new version of Barbie out, an artificially intelligent one, and James Vlahos is with us. He wrote about her. He wrote about the development of Hello Barbie for the New York Times Magazine. Well, right now, they're in the testing phase at Mattel in collaboration with Toy Talk, these developers you spoke of. How are kids and parents responding?
So Hello Barbie comes out in mid-November, so we don't really know what the market in general and what parents in general are going to think of her. But judging from what people, just reactions I've gotten to the article, both online and in person, there's a fair amount of concern out there. And people have read a lot of science fiction and they've seen the movies and they have this fear of this little blonde cyborg, blonde haired, marching into your home and talking and interacting with children. And it understandably makes people nervous. At the same time, there's this sense that, hey, you know, the artificial intelligence future that we've always been promised, it's arriving as well. And a robot best friend, that's something we've been dreaming about. So it's almost as if as much as people want to be skeptical about this, they're also excited.
Yeah. Well, you referenced the movie Her. Now, that's this film with Joaquin Phoenix who falls in love with the operating system on his telephone, beautifully and seductively voiced by Scarlett Johansson. And there becomes this kind of question about the inability to distinguish what is real and what is not. But in a way, it doesn't really matter because he gets something out of this. I mean, how do you look at Hello Barbie in that kind of context?
You know, there's actually a lot of research that people in the robotics community have been doing with both children and adults to assess how real or not they think robots are and computer programs that pretend to have personalities. And the research is really interesting because on one hand, it shows that people think that robots can have feelings, they can have intentions, they can have thoughts, they can even have moral standing. They deserve to be treated fairly and justly. So you have that on one side of the fence, But then on the other, if you really probe and ask people, you know, do you think the robot is actually alive? Is it biologically alive? And they say no. Like they understand that they're dealing with a machine. So what the researchers think that we're seeing is this recognition of a third category of life, basically, which is an entity that's not fully alive and yet isn't an inert computer either. And people seem ready to embrace relationships with those type of technologies, such that the movie Her is, it's not as far off in the future as it might seem, and people don't need the technology to be as perfect and as seamless as it is in a movie like that, because we are a long ways off from that level of sophistication in artificial intelligence.
James, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
James Vlahos is a freelance writer. His article, Barbie Wants to Get to Know Your Child, is in the New York Times Magazine. The article is fascinating, and so are the comments, and you can find them all at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about Barbie's AI makeover, just one innovation in a long trend of trying to make toys more interactive. Well, there's a whole world of toys designed to help build critical thinking skills and scientific literacy, toys that can also be very expensive. One educator and scientist hopes to give all kids the opportunity to play with a new kind of inexpensive educational toy. Producer Angela Johnston of KALW reports.
Despite the familiar song, no one is celebrating a birthday here today. I'm in a lab tucked away in the basement of a Stanford University engineering building. And the song coming from the tiny hand-cranked music box is actually, well, science. This music box has a plastic chip attached to it, a little silicon box filled with tiny channels of different fluids or chemicals that can be mixed together. It was designed by Manu Prakash, a bioengineering professor here at Stanford. When you crank the handle, the gears not only make sound, they are also triggering tiny pumps in the plastic chip to release minute amounts of chemical fluids, something you need to listen even closer to hear.
This is coding a specific chemistry that we care about. When I'm running this chip, whatever code was on this will get executed as chemistry on this chip.
As you turn the tape, more chemicals get released and mixed together. Prakash says these little boxes can be used for testing everything from disease markers to soil or water quality. Now, there isn't a water quality test, or any test out there, that actually plays Happy Birthday when you run it. A simple water quality test would actually sound something like this. Simply put, it's the sound of a ratio. One reagent or chemical mixed with half of another. Prakash's research assistant, Ben Alpers, explains.
For every one hole you punch in this line, you punch three holes in the other line, and every hole is one pump of that fluid.
The more complicated the ratio, the more complicated the sound. This way of mixing chemicals together, something called microfluidics, has been around for a while. But Prakash says it requires a lot of money and infrastructure, something that doctors and scientists in developing countries don't always have easy access to.
It's an expensive enterprise. What we wanted to do was bring out this idea of being able to do controlled reactions and handling chemicals completely in an automated way, but anywhere in the world. So we built something that doesn't require any power, doesn't require any electricity.
And it only costs $5. Building inexpensive universal scientific tools like this is one of the goals of Prakash's lab at Stanford. He calls it frugal science.
We've tested our instruments in Nigeria, Uganda. We did a small trial in Ghana. We are working in Cameroon. Recently,
But he has another aim that's just as important, fostering a non-goal-oriented curiosity among both kids and adults. He says that's something missing in science education today.
Because early on, kids get very focused on thinking about, hey, I want to solve this problem or that problem. So the tools that we make are completely open-ended. We really don't tell people what you want to do with it.
This curiosity-driven exploration is most evident in Prakash's other invention, the Foldscope. It's a paper microscope that's built by folding, like origami.
All the components are printed flat on a sheet of paper, and then you fold it together and you get a fully functional microscope.
One that you can slip into your back pocket. It's a tough little tool. Throw it off a three-story building or in the washing machine. Prakash has tried both. The Foldscope magnifies objects over 2,000 times. It can pick up subcellular structures like parasites, microbes, things 1/1,000,000th of a meter in size. Traditional microscopes of this strength cost upwards of $1,000. The Foldscope costs 50 cents.
Even though it looks like a simple object, it's a very powerful instrument.
At a recent event at Stanford's bioengineering department, Prakash's team distributed dozens of these Foldscopes to children. They could look at anything they wanted. Legs of an ant, strands of their hair. 13-year-old Jalen Devados and her 11-year-old brother Elias built one.
We were looking at little flatworms through a paper microscope called a foldoscope. I learned that you can see any kind of organism through just a 50-cent piece of paper and plastic.
I thought it was pretty cool because it only cost like 50 cents to make and it still works pretty well.
The kids are essentially beta testers, Prakash says. He has also created what he calls the 10,000 microscope project. Anyone who proposes a novel experiment with the Foldscope will get one. They received over 12,000 entries from over 130 countries, and it's still growing. They plan to ship 50,000 at the end of the month. There have been entries from award-winning chemists and biologists.
The goal is that, you know, curiosity is everywhere, and every question is a good question as long as you're passionate about asking it.
And Prakash says the DIY aspect of these tools can bring a deeper understanding and empowerment.
So we enforce this idea that people are going to build these instruments, modify, hack, and do whatever they want to do on top of it, which is also the spirit of all the instruments that we make. And there lies the idea of making sure that you don't consider scientific instruments as black boxes. It's a great instrument. It's a great scientific instrument, actually, but you don't have any idea of conceptually what went in it.
Prakash believes that the world will be a healthier and better place if everybody has the chance to make a scientific discovery, regardless of where you were born, your income level, or your age.
Right now, 2 billion kids on the planet, we're not giving them the choice. We're telling them, here is a book, pass all these hoops, and if you qualify to a certain extent, then you enter the club for doing science, which is a broken model of how scientific thinking should propagate.
And because of that, Prakash hopes someday every scientist and every kid can carry a Foldscope or a music box chemistry set in their back pocket.
And that piece was produced by Angela Johnston. It may be the most well-known and frequently performed song in the world, and possibly the most consistently poorly sung.
Happy birthday,
last week, a California judge's decision freed the lyrics to the Happy Birthday song from decades of copyright protection and made headlines around the world. But don't blow your candles out yet. That ruling may have made a confusing legal battle even more befuddling. The judge decided that Warner Music does not own the lyrics, as that company has insisted for decades. And while many claim this ruling makes it legal for everyone to sing it, it's still likely that someone else owns the rights. Well, perhaps it's safest to take the tack of Scott Kies, who thinks we should all stop singing Happy Birthday. I spoke to him when he first made the case, before the ruling, in Pacific Standard magazine. He began with the all-too-familiar and awkward celebration scene.
I'll tell you, I was at a coworker's birthday party just a few weeks ago, and, you know, it was really nice affairs after work, and a couple people brought in some nice craft beers and you know, brought him in, told him it was a meeting. He walked in and, oh, you know, surprise, happy birthday. It was really nice and fun until all of a sudden one of our coworkers, Lauren, decided to ask those five dreaded words, should we sing happy birthday? And, you know, everybody in the group froze because, you know, nobody wants to be that curmudgeon who says, you know, no, let's not sing Josh happy birthday. And so, you know, nobody can be the voice of reason here. And so while that idea is just floating up there, all of a sudden, Lauren has to buckle under the weight of her own suggestion and start singing out the first few words, you know, happy birthday. And then all of a sudden, we're all faced with the choice. Do we let her sing on her own, in which case she has to either trail off after one verse or sing the entire thing by herself? Or do we all go ahead and join her, in which case we all have to go ahead and try to harmonize it and probably do it pretty poorly, which we ultimately ended up doing.
Well, before we get into your proposed band, let's go back to the birth of the birthday song, 1893. You looked into where it came from. Tell us more.
Yeah, so, you know, the history of the Happy Birthday song is actually kind of one that goes way back, and there's actually surprising mystery about it, considering the fact that, like you mentioned, it's cited as the best-known and most frequently sung song in the entire world. We know for sure where the tune came from. It is an 1893 song composed by two kindergarten teachers from Kentucky named Patty and Mildred Hill, who originally wrote a song called Good Morning to All. They were kindergarten teachers during the day, but then at night they kind of moonlighted as songwriters, composers. They liked to try to come up with songs that they thought their students would be able to harmonize and enjoy. And
Do you know the words to Good Morning to All?
Yeah, so it's similarly simple to Happy Birthday. It's Good Morning to All, Good Morning to All, Good Morning, Dear Children, Good Morning to All. You can see where Happy Birthday comes from.
Well, any theories on who substituted the Happy Birthday lyrics? Was it Mildred and Patty Hill?
Well, so that's where the mystery comes from. Somewhere in the next two or three decades, the song went from just Good Morning to All to all of a sudden being sung at birthday parties with these new lyrics that, you know, the lyrics that we know today of Happy Birthday. But it's not really clear who first came up with those Happy Birthday words. There's been a professor, Robert Brownice, at George Washington University, who has written, you know, extensive studies and looking into where the origins of the song comes from. And all he's been able to determine is that we're not exactly sure who wrote them, but it's almost for sure that it was not the Hill sisters.
Mm-hmm. Well, although no one can prove that the Hill sisters wrote those lyrics, the copyright has been fought for since the Hill family. In fact, it was caught up in a pretty famous battle back in 1934. Can you give us that story?
Sure. So you know, it became more and more popular in the early 20th century. In 1934, Irving Berlin had written a Broadway musical called As Thousands Cheer that used the birthday song in it. Now, a sister of Patty and Mildred Hill, one of whom had passed away by this point, actually ended up suing Irving Berlin for unauthorized use of the song, claiming that her family owned the rights to it. That case ended up getting dismissed, but Jessica Hill, the third sister, ended up working with a music publisher to copyright the song the next year, I believe, in 1935. And this copyright is actually still in effect today, almost 80 years later. It's still under copyright and generating millions in licensing fees from its popularity.
Millions? Who pays to use the Happy Birthday song?
Well, your listeners don't have to worry that they might be footed with a bill at their next kid's birthday party, thankfully. But if there's a TV show, a movie, you know, a restaurant chain, anything on down the line, some business that uses the Happy Birthday song is subject to copyright fees, just as they would be with any other song that's copyrighted today by, you know, Lady Gaga or whoever. So this is why, for instance, if next time one of your listeners goes to Red Robin or Joe's Crab Shack or a place like that, they won't be singing the Happy Birthday song. These restaurant chains come up with their own unique takes on the birthday song. They have their own version of it in order to try to avoid those licensing fees. But at the same time, you know, there are businesses and whatnot that will just go ahead and pay for the licensing fee. And it's estimated that in total, the Happy Birthday song generates about $2 million each year in licensing fees.
Wowie. We're speaking with Scott Kai, senior reporter for Think Progress. He wrote the article and is starting the campaign, Why We Should Stop Singing Happy Birthday. The article was in Pacific Standard. $2 million. Scott, how did this song evolve from a little Kentucky backwoods kindergarten ditty into such a powerhouse?
You know, it's a fascinating, fascinating, perfect storm of factors that ended up resulting in the Happy Birthday song being the phenomenon that we know it today. You know, back in the 1800s, there was really no such thing as a birthday party. Birthdays just didn't have the same grandeur and excitement that they do today. But a number of things started to develop around the middle of the 19th century. For instance, birthday cakes arose in the 1840s, and the concept of birthday parties among kids of the same age started a little bit later in the 1800s. Before that, birthday parties, even for kids, tended to be affairs for adults, where kids were essentially showing how good their manners were or how, you know, upstanding and involved a citizen they were. But, you know, as society developed, as people started to get a little bit wealthier and we started to develop a little bit more child-oriented view of adolescence, birthday parties rose too as a result. By the early 20th century or so, the kind of modern birthday party really started to take hold, you know, with birthday cakes, with that was celebrating the child, that had the child's friends over. And so, you know, we had all the kind of prerequisites that we would need for something like the birthday song to take hold, just starting to take shape right as the birthday song was invented in the early 20th century.
Okay, so you, early in the 21st century, propose that we should stop singing Happy Birthday. Scott Kies, make your case.
That's right. You know, it boils down to two very simple points. One, nobody likes singing it. And two, nobody likes having it sung to them. Now, you know, I will make a slight exception here that I think we should continue singing Happy Birthday to kids because, you know, it is fun when you're a kid to feel like celebrated in the center of attention. But I think once we get to about age 14 or so, you know, this is right around kids are in middle school. They want to assert their independence. They want to show that they're no longer just a young kid anymore. I think right about then is the right time to let this person have their own autonomy and dignity and stop subjecting them to the awkwardness of being publicly sung to.
So that's from the celebrant's perspective. How about the singers?
Exactly. Well, so the problem with the way that we sing Happy Birthday, especially, you know, in an office or to other at adult birthday parties, for one, very few among us are actually good singers. And so when we try to combine the fact that we're not good singers, we're not in a particularly forgiving acoustic setting, you know, we're not singing in the shower or the Kennedy Center or anything like that, and we're not singing with a group that has practiced together or has any harmony, it tends to come out like the clip that you played at the beginning of the segment where it sounds, frankly, pretty bad. So, you know, I propose that we all just go ahead and cut the charade and say, you know, after we turn 14, let's still celebrate people's birthdays, but let's go ahead and not sing them the Happy Birthday and see if they enjoy it more. I suspect they will.
Scott, are people going to know what to do at your next birthday party? They all on notice?
You know, I'll tell you, even this morning, there was someone had a birthday, and I heard the birthday song being sung, and my coworker's looking at me like, Scott, better go lay down the law on them, you know, better go tell them. I'm very curious to see what happens next December when my birthday rolls around.
Scott Kai's there talking about an article he wrote for Pacific Standard called Why We Should Stop Singing Happy Birthday. Well, after 100 plus years of regular use, maybe the problem has less to do with the tradition of celebratory singing as it does the song itself. Given that Happy Birthday consists of only 5 words, it couldn't be all that hard to come up with a catchy and fresh alternative, could it? To find out, NHPR's Weekend Edition host Brady Carlson joined producers Maureen McMurray and Taylor Quimby in a studio to come up with a new version.
So here's what I'm thinking.
Lay it on us.
A birthday song has to have a few basic elements. It's got to be pretty simple. It in some way needs to celebrate a birthday.
Yes. It needs to be personalized.
And it needs to, exactly, it needs to be customizable.
No mention of age.
Yeah.
No mention of how far you've gotten along, that you've lived so bloody long.
No big deal, another year went by.
And you haven't accomplished all those things you set off to accomplish.
Oh. No.
Do you think there should be 2 separate songs, one for kids and one for adults?
No.
So just so it has to be...
It has to be universal. You were born in 1964. You were born.
Some of those chain restaurant birthday songs basically aren't songs at all. They're just chants, and it's incredibly unnerving. The older I get, the more weirded out I get about people chanting things when they come toward me.
Yeah.
Maybe the focus should... Maybe we should change the focus to the mom.
Maybe the customizable part is how long the mother was in labor.
You took 15 hours. You took 15 hours.
One of the songs that really... struck me that I listened to before we sat down to talk was the song Mr. Rogers sang on his show.
So what was his?
Happy birthday, dear friend.
Lisa, it's your birthday. Happy birthday, Lisa.
Sounds so much smoother when the two of you were singing along.
Tick, tock, tick.
Oh, that's
tock,
good.
Tick, tock.
There
tick,
goes another
tock,
year for tick, Cassandra.
Tock,
she's
tick,
getting older.
Tick, tock. I actually like this. I actually like this.
I do. That's good.
You know what? The thing about that happy birthday song is so awkward because we're not acknowledging what we all truly feel about. So maybe we should commit to going dark.
You need a song that acknowledges the
like
elephant
the
in the room.
Tock.
Tick, tock. Tick,
you now
tock,
are 78.
Tick,
I hope
tick,
you've got your living
tock,
will
tick,
in place.
That's just so terrible.
Wait, so does it start with 1 year older, 1 year wiser? Does it go 1 year older, 1 year wiser? Let's all hope you don't turn into a miser, Cassandra.
Maybe we don't even mention the age. I don't know. Maybe
yeah.
It's 1 year older, 1 year wiser. It's your special day.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yay.
Tick, tock, tick, tock. 1 year
tick,
older,
tock,
1 year
tick,
wiser.
Tick,
it's your special
tock,
day.
Tick,
yay.
That's it.
We did
That's
it.
That's it.
All right. High fives, everybody.
Nice.
Woo.
Yeah.
Well, it's been over a year since we came up with our birthday song, TikTok. So has it been added to your celebratory party singing repertoire? Or perhaps you're happy sticking with the classics. Either way, let us know what you think about the song's long copyright battle at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Thanks so much for spending some time with listener-supported NHPR. You'll never miss a trick when you sign up for our podcast. You can just go to wordofmouthradio.org or search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you enjoy that kind of convenience, do us a favor, write a review or rate it on iTunes. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.